While life on Earth may not always be safe or easy, traveling the spaceways comes with its own host of hazards. There's space junk, sub-zero temperatures, and not to mention a complete lack of oxygen. In this piece from our November-December issue, a mech finds himself dragged into a daring rescue mission on Saturn's icy moon, Enceladus. Here is author Bill Frank with an inspired reading of his story, Moon Unit.
I heard the grunts of half of my tourists as they fought the resistance of their spacesuits with every move they made. Precise motion in those pressurized bastards is impossible. And once you get to where you're going, you still have to find the energy to do whatever it is that you intended to do in the first place. No thank you. I rode across a bridge on the surface of Enceladus without wearing one of those goddamn things. My human consciousness inhabited a Hochidae Explorer 1070 deluxe model moon unit mech body, which I must admit is by far the best moon unit I've ever experienced. I was born on Earth, but by the time I was 20, I knew I wanted out. Too crowded and too hot. It took 20 years of living small and saving every Hamilton dollar I could, but I finally got my consciousness downloaded into a secure server. And that's the last I remember of life in a human body. The Hochidae was my pride and joy. I'd saved up for a decade to get it, living in a shitty Pytheon 1700 unofficial motto, inferior engineering, the whole time. I turned away from my tour group, four bios, real humans, and six mechs like me, and gazed out over starkly beautiful black and white Enceladus. The surface is an odd combination of smooth and craggy. The smooth areas are kind of lumpy and are broken up by sections of craggy, sharp canyons and cliffs. Everything is shockingly white. If the light were better, I'd suspect that looking at the surface would be blinding for bios who don't have internal light filters in their eyes. "Mr. Fuzzle?" asked Liang, the youngest of my bio tourists. I pegged her at 19, but I was just guessing. "You can call me Riley," I said. "How do you turn up the heat? My fingers are cold." I explained the temperature interface to her. "It's crazy cold this far away from the sun. Minus 200 degrees Fahrenheit today, and every day on Enceladus." The oohs and ahs started as we got closer to the nearest geyser, where snow was falling gently upward toward Saturn's rings. Just as I was getting ready to do a routine inspection of three of the midsection bridge struts, I felt the whole bridge move. Shit. If this was a quake, this could be bad. The ice fields near the south pole of Enceladus are not particularly stable. The upside is that you've got these amazing geysers that draw tourists from all over the solar system. The downside is that sometimes the ice shifts are dramatic, and the bridges, and people, can get badly damaged.
"Do we need to go back?" asked Liang. "I'm going to do a quick inspection, and then I'll let you know," I said in my calm, reassuring park ranger voice. We glided along the bridge in our foot restraints. On Enceladus, the gravity is so low you worry about flying off every time you take a step. You won't actually float away, but it damn sure feels like you will. I commanded the conveyor tech to stop us at a good spot for my inspection. I detached a cable cam from my right side and moved it over the rail. The first strut I checked was reporting higher than spec strain, but nothing alarming. I upped the magnification and shut off the feed for a few seconds as the image stabilization kicked in. Since there's minimal atmosphere, you can't fly drones on Enceladus, so you manage with other, more challenging tech. A deeper inspection revealed more serious damage to one of the bridge supports. "All right, everybody, I'm going to turn us around and head us back to the airlock," I said. "But we just got out here," said Liang. "It's a precaution. The ice beneath us isn't entirely stable. It's best to be near the airlock when the bridges are adjusting." "Minerva, we're coming back in," I said, via the comm system. Minerva was my supervisor back inside the base.
"We felt the quake in here, too," she said.
"What's the prediction?" I asked.
"Stand by."
The four bios in my tour group included Roberto and Liang Xin, family members who had recently emigrated to Titan. This was their first trip after the big move. The Shins were clearly a wealthy family who decided to spread the family genes to the outer planets. Even though only idiots would lock themselves in a tiny ship for years to drag their human bodies to the outer solar system, I felt a small amount of sympathy for Liang. She'd be expected to spend the next two decades of her life cranking out children.
One of the primary reasons to download into a mech body was ridiculously easy space travel. You beam to any location in the solar system as data. Then you get downloaded into a mech body at your destination. It was only 2 months ago that I had myself beamed from Titan, the place I consider to be home, to Enceladus to work as a tech. The mortgage transfer from my crappy Pytheon on Titan to my excellent Hushadan Enceladus was a pain in the ass. But what's the point of being able to travel from one planetary system to another on a beam of light if you don't spend the money to actually do it? Now, the mechs in my tour group were a different story. Pranisha Narayana Swami, the Deputy Director of Logistics for the Callisto Settlement Project, was among them. The main reason I was an Enceladus Park Ranger was to gain enough experience in a Hoshide Moon unit to be hired for the construction of the first base on Callisto. I'd be a pioneer, opening up settlement of a new world. She could put in a good word for me to get the job I wanted, so I was being extra nice to her. Then there was my most entertaining mech tourist, who loved this place so much he returned every few months. "Dimly, back so soon?" I asked. "Of course, old chap. This is an excellent place to visit, although it is a bit on the cold side." He claimed to be Sir Lawrence Warwick Overton Dimbley, but none of us believed him. He was too good-natured to be true nobility. "Do you have extra fingers in the replacement shop?" asked Dimbley. "You know we do," I said. "Yes, but do you have them at a reasonable prices? It cost me quite a bit to replace a simple left thumb after your last tour," he said with a wink. Mech tourists were responsible for damage to their own rented bodies. I wasn't the guide on that tour, if you remember, but I did tell you not to stick your hand into a snowbank. "It's a shame your good advice went unheeded," he said. My components were designed to withstand temperatures down to minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Plus, I had heaters built into my Hoshide, and I'd invested in good cold weather gear for this job. I'd last 10 or 15 minutes longer, in the worst case, than a human in a spacesuit. "Okay, I'm seeing..." Minerva might have continued talking, but all of my attention shifted to the violent surge of the bridge beneath my feet. I grabbed a handrail before the crack of the bridge flung me off into the sky. Unfortunately, it didn't help much, since the handrail snapped off the bridge too. So I flew, and spun, and rolled. I saw glimpses of the others doing the same. I tossed the chunk of handrail aside as I spun through the sky. Time to use the prime feature of my Hoshide Moon unit for the first time. I yanked the small tethers for the rip-away shoulders on my heavily insulated coat and activated my cold gas emergency stabilization thruster system, known as an EST. At the last second, I remembered to hold my arms out to the side for roll stabilization. The cold gas thrusters fired, automatically slowing my roll and spin until I oriented with my feet toward the surface. The scene below was chaos. Some of the tourists were spinning away, like me. Others were closer to the surface. One of them bounced while I was watching. The bridge was in several pieces. The good news was that at least half of my tourists were still on a piece of the bridge that was whole. They'd be okay for a little while. Those on the ice would freeze to death in minutes if I couldn't get to them. The transponder showed that Ortiz was only a few meters away from the bridge. Narayana Swami was further away, but still reasonably close. Ortiz first, then Narayana Swami. Rescuing Ortiz would be straightforward. After that, it was going to get tricky. I commanded the EST to take me to the bridge. As I flew through the sky, I had my navigation system map the locations of the tourists thrown from the bridge. Ortiz, Narayana Swami, Dimbley, Liang Xin, and Roberto Xin. I bounced to the part of the bridge that was thankfully still whole and connected to the airlock, where the other five tourists were holding on. "Cold gas fuel is at 60%, said my EST control system. "Deactivate EST." Deactivated. Shit. I knew the system was only designed to save myself in a situation like this, but come on. It took almost half of the nitrogen just to stabilize me and get me back to the bridge. I didn't need to fly anymore to get Ortiz, but it was clear that I wouldn't have enough fuel to rescue the other four of my tourists. "Minerva, we have five on the bridge. How's the conveyor?" "Unrecoverable as far as diagnostics is concerned," she said. Not a surprise, given how sensitive the smart material command system was. "You're going to have to pull yourselves back to the airlock," I said to the lucky tourists. "Make sure your tethers are still connected to the handrails. Use the handrails to work your way back to the lodge." "But I can't reach the handrail. I need you to come," said a panicked voice.
You're going to have to figure it out. I need to focus on the people out on the ice who can't save themselves, I said. But we need your help, said the voice. Lucky for me, Gwyn took over and gently started guiding the bridge group back to the lodge. She did so well, I resolved to ask my bosses to give her a lifetime discount for kicking ass in a tough situation. I'm on my way to the airlock to bring in your tourists, said Minerva. Thanks. I clamped my tether to a section of the bridge rail that was still intact. Then I climbed over and gently pushed myself backwards in the direction I hoped Ortiz was in. I managed 3 hops before the cold made it through the bottom of my left boot. Shit, I said. I bounced myself and then explained the plan to Ortiz. I'm going to hook you to this tether, and then you're going to get your ass back to the bridge, okay? Jesus, it's cold. Yep, it's probably the large ice field surrounding you, I said as I completed the tether exchange. Only ranger tethers can be disconnected from a surface suit. Tourist tethers were permanently attached to their suit. I had to disconnect my entire tether control mechanism, including the reel, and hook it to Ortiz's suit. All right, slowly reel in the tether as you bounce back, I said. Ortiz didn't react. Ortiz, it's much warmer on the bridge. Okay, he said, and he began moving. Ortiz was the easy one. Now I needed to make an effort to rescue a dumbass bio. Bios were supposed to be my priority, but they were stupid. If they wanted to live a long time out here, occupying a biological human body just didn't make any sense. Liang was fairly close to Narayana Swami. I could go for a twofer, save Narayana Swami and keep my job, and more importantly, my moon unit. I gently hopped a few steps away from Ortiz and then told the EST to reactivate and take me to Narayana Swami. Reactivated. I felt the gentle thrust as I flew up and away from the ice. But I cursed every time the goddamn thrusters fired. I didn't need perfect control. Fuel is at 40%, said the calm voice of my moon unit. Damn. Can you switch to minimal fuel consumption mode? Minimum consumption mode will activate at 10%. There were rumors that in the early days of airplanes, the pilot had to control the aircraft without the help of automation. That, of course, was ridiculous. No one could possibly fly without automation. But damn, it sure would have been nice to be able to override the fuel usage algorithms in my EST. The ice slowly got closer and closer as I controlled my roll to face toward Narayana Swami. I kept myself loose since the impact would be gentle, I hoped. The EST guided me nice and easy to Narayana Swami. It was going to be hard to grab her. I needed to keep my arms in the prescribed position so the cold gas thrusters could stop me properly, but I also needed to time it perfectly to get a solid hold. It didn't matter. The automated guidance system of the EST landed me perfectly right next to her, but the jet backwash pushed her further away from me. Fuel at 20%. Deactivate EST. Deactivated. I carefully bounced toward where the jets had pushed Narayana Swami. I lost my balance and pitched forward, but caught myself before my face could crash onto the ice. Then I gently pushed myself upright. Jesus, my fingers were getting cold. Like Dimbley, I was going to have to buy some new ones after this. One of the rules of being a park ranger was, always have a rope. And I did. Our ropes included loop clamps on the ends. There was no way anyone could tie a half-decent knot in a rope at minus 200 degrees. I hooked a loop of the rope around Narayana Swami's waist. Now for the real challenge. I didn't have a wire tie or anything like it to properly secure the rope. I was going to have to manage with barely usable frozen fingers. I pulled 6 coils of the rope free, so there were about 3 meters of free rope between me and Narayana Swami. I used my right hand to wrap the fingers of my left hand around the remaining coils of the rope and held on. Ready to hop? I asked. Why are we going that way? Asked Narayana Swami. You're not the only one on the ice. We're going to grab Liang before we head to the bridge, I said. Company policy? She asked. Company policy, I said. It was the simplest answer, and it made me look good. I appreciated it. We're going to hop over to Liang, okay? The hopping didn't go particularly well, but we managed. There were several falls and a lot of cursing. Stopping was terrible. After the spinning and bouncing, coiling, uncoiling, coiling, and forcible uncoiling of the rope, we arrived, mostly face down, at our destination. Liang, can you hear me? I asked. It's so cold, she said quietly. I could see her shivering through her helmet faceplate. So how are you going to get me back? She asked. That's a tough one. Don't tell the others, but I'm already low on fuel, so I won't be able to fly around much longer.
Everyone whose radio was working could hear me. It was my way of letting them know how bad things were. "Liang, can you grab the rope?" I asked. "I can't feel my fingers," she said. She'd probably never feel her real fingers again. I slowly reached out and grasped her upper arm, just below the shoulder. Lifting a person in a pressure suit is very easy in low gravity. The problem comes when you want to stop lifting. I very gently pushed my toes downward and leaned forward. The slowness with which I moved was agonizing, but I was under control. I got her off the ground, and we gently floated upward for a few slow seconds. Eventually, we began to drift back down. The landing was gentle, so we were able to stay upright. There was still some slack between us and Narayana Swami, so all three of us were upright. That sure as hell wasn't going to last. Synchronizing three hopping people was nearly impossible. I landed on my back when we were about halfway to the bridge. Of course, Liang smacked into me just as I was bouncing upward, and I held too tightly onto the rope, pulling Narayana Swami off her feet. Our slow motion crash became a normal speed flail. We spun, tumbled, and bounced, mostly toward the bridge, until we had about 15 meters left. It took a few minutes to untangle myself from the rope, but we would have been a lot faster if my fingers were working properly. The fingers on my right hand were fading fast. "Okay, people, I need one more hop from each of you. Then I can grab the bridge and haul you in. Can you both hear me?" "Yes," said Narayana Swami. Liang said nothing. "Liang?" I couldn't get a response. She didn't answer, and she didn't move. Shit. "Hey, Narayana Swami, why don't you start bouncing toward the bridge? Drop the rope and see how far you can get. I'll keep it wrapped around her and drag her with me," I said. "You can't just leave her and help me?" she asked. "Company policy," I said. I understood her attitude about buyouts. Hell, it was my attitude. "I'll be dragging her and helping you." "Okay." She made it most of the way to the bridge before face planting on the ice. I didn't have it so easy. I'd have been happy to fall only once. You see, each time I pulled on the rope and got Liang moving towards the bridge, there was an equal and opposite reaction. I got pulled away from the bridge. I'd struggle like a goddamn cartoon mouse to stop moving in the wrong direction, and then bam, Liang would crash into me, and we'd spin in circles, getting the rope tangled worse. Physics sucks balls, by the way. When I stumbled to Narayana Swami, she was about 7 meters from the bridge. "I can't feel my hands or my feet," she said. I let go of the rope, helped her get up, grabbed her under the arm, and we awkwardly hopped to the bridge. I helped her flip over the handrail and told her to pull herself to the airlock, using the handrail. "Minerva, how's it going?" I asked. "The outer airlock door is open and your group is starting to ingress," she said. "Good. Can you come out here and bring in Narayana Swami? She's on the bridge." "On my way," she said. I focused on getting Liang the final 15 meters to the bridge. I was about 1 meter shy of the bridge when the rope went taut. "Liang, I'm going to make a heroic jump to the bridge. We're both going to get yanked and tossed around, but when it's over, we'll both be off the ice, okay?" She made sort of a grunting sound, which was good news, so I pulled her gently toward the bridge. When I neared, I reached out my hand to grab the rail, and my frozen fingers couldn't catch it. Ah! I spun for a bit and realized I was heading toward the other bridge rail. I was able to pull on the rope enough to change my body position, and I wrapped my arms around the rail and held on tight. Since all of my situational awareness cameras were frozen, I had no idea where Liang was. I just held on for what seemed a very long time until I felt a relatively gentle tug, followed by a few more. When the pulls on the rope had quieted down, I loosened my grip on the rail and carefully moved around. Liang had settled about 2 meters from the bridge. I moved to the other side of the bridge, wrapped one arm around the rail, and used the other to tug at the rope. My fingers didn't move, but I could use them like hooks to pull at the loose portion of the rope and drag her to the bridge. I'm not quite sure how I managed to flip her over the rail, but I did it. The two of us sat on the bridge, freezing our asses off, both my mechanical one and her biological one. "How are you feeling, Liang?" "My dad," she answered. "Please get my dad." God damn it. She finally speaks. "No. Thank you for saving my life. No. You're a huge hero and I'll love you forever. No, just another impossible task request." My left hand was no longer functional. My right hand was failing.
The company had better replace every component of my moon unit for this shit.
He's too far away, I said. Please get my dad, she said again.
I can't save him, I wanted to say. There was no chance now. The best I could do was drag his corpse back to the ranger station. I didn't have to deal with death out here. All of the people I was closest to were mechs. We didn't die. Yes, I knew bios on Titan, and some I considered friends, but none of them had died since I got out here. I remember death from my time on Earth, but it never hit me that hard. My parents were still alive when I did the download. I was living out here when they died. I beamed into a rental for the funerals, but I hadn't really been a part of their lives for years by then. Shit. He was a dumbass for dragging his daughter out here, but I couldn't let him die without trying to help. More importantly, my moon unit was insured, and the company would take care of me, especially since I would be following their policy. Dim, I said.
You on your way yet? He replied.
I hope you haven't done anything memorable since your last backup. There was a long pause. He knew.
Just this, he said. And it's been quite the adventure. Are you sure you can't get to me? I'd really like to remember this. I'll take you to Europa with me. I've a lovely place there.
Damn. I'd never been to Europa. Too pricey. But I hear it's wonderful.
Sorry, Dim. This guy doesn't have a backup, I said. Well, there it is, said Dim. The fool cost me quite an adventurous memory. Good luck.
And then my goddamn low temperature alarm went off. I had about 10 minutes before my limbs would be too cold to move. I didn't have enough gas in my EST for the rescue, but I did know roughly where Roberto was. So I took a few minutes to untangle the rope. It's tough when your fingers don't move, but I managed. I made a loop and hooked it around the handrail on the bridge. Then I hopped out onto the ice, carefully pulling the rope behind me. I hopped a few more times and then arrested my momentum. I gingerly set the end of the rope down on the ice. Take a navigation mark here. Call it rope, I said. Marked. Activate EST. I commanded the EST to fly me to Roberto. Fuel reserves are low. Recommend return to the ranger station. Nope. Target Roberto Shin, I said. The alarm sounded again. Shit. That would be the third low temperature alarm from the center of my heavily insulated abdominal cavity. So that's pretty much it. The Hoshide was designed to protect the inner abdominal cavity. If the inner abdominal cavity was freezing, the rest of the unit was lost. So the last ditch was to protect the brain of the user. My brain was about to freeze, and that would be the end of my favorite Hoshide. Modify shutdown priorities. Visuals required, I said as Roberto's prone body came into view near a canyon, spewing gorgeous backlit ice particles. Low fuel warning. Minimum fuel consumption algorithm engaged, it said as I spun slowly through the sky. I wouldn't be able to keep my eyes on Roberto as I approached, since the EST wouldn't use the remaining fuel to correct the spin. The EST set me down hard near the edge of the canyon. It took a few bounces before I got control of myself. Fuel at 5%. I wouldn't say Roberto or I were lucky, because you know that's not true. But he was laying in a flat spot, a few meters away from a steep drop into the canyon. Hey, Roberto, how's it going? Through his helmet faceplate, I could see his eyes flutter a bit, but no other movement. My low-temperature alarm went off again. Shutting off semi-critical systems, my body said. Great. My hands, and all peripheral tools associated with them, were off now. And then, shit, I need navigation to stay on. I need to know where rope is. Navigation system will be shut down in 1 minute. I need more than 1 minute, I said. Power margin is unavailable, said my body. So I hooked my useless hands under Roberto's shoulders, and I carefully lifted him up. I turned until my navigation system pointed me at the rope. Activate EST. Activated. Low fuel warning. Take me to rope. Unfortunately, in my frozen condition, I forgot to lift up one of my arms for roll control. Roll control unavailable, said the EST as it lifted us off the ground. We were about 12 meters above the ground and spinning when the EST ran out of gas. To add insult to injury, the low temperature alarm sounded again. Suit 37, what is occupant's condition? I asked. Occupant is deceased, said the suit. Shit. I'm glad that moon units don't make tears.
I'm also glad that my radio had a silent button. A mech can certainly be racked with sobs. A mech can still feel emotional pain. Show me the location of rope. Navigation unavailable. System shutdown commencing. Ah, shit. I was going to lose my moon unit because of some stupid bios who came all the way out here to crank out more stupid bio babies. God damn it. This is not how things should happen. I made a smart choice to upload my consciousness into a body suited for deep space, which was disposable in an extreme case like this. Those morons didn't, and now my precious moon unit was going to be totaled. So I sat with Roberto while my mechanical body failed. Fortunately, my eyes were one of the last things to go. I spent the last few minutes of my precious moon unit taking in the beauty of the geysers of Enceladus backlit by the almost warm light of Saturn. Mr. Fuzzle, hello? There was a mech man standing over me, asking questions. He looked about 50, which meant that he wanted to present himself as youthful but wise. I immediately didn't trust him. Yeah, I said. Good morning. I'm Junichi Friedrichsen, said the man. Is it actually morning, I asked? No, it's just after 1800, Titan Standard. I turned my head. So something's happened to my... What the hell? My arm was the wrong color, and the wrong shape, and the hand was just a standard hand. None of my tool interfaces were there. Oh, shit! This isn't my Hoshiday 1070. What the hell kind of body am I in? I'm sorry, Mr. Fuzzle. You're in a Pytheon JDX. Pytheons were pieces of warmed-over crap. What the hell am I doing in a Pytheon? I carry full replacement coverage for my Hoshiday. Yes, sir. Galactico Insurance has informed us that you'll get the first Hoshiday in the system when one becomes available. Why the hell isn't one available now? The official word from Galactico is that the shipping company, Universal Express, is investigating. Then, Junichi leaned in, as if he were a co-conspirator of mine, and whispered, "We think the Hoshiday shipment was hijacked." "God damn it, I can't do my job in this piece of shit," I yelled. Junichi shook his head and clucked. "I don't think it'll make you feel any better to know, but most people react like you do." "No, it doesn't make me feel better." "I'm just the messenger," said Junichi. "What the hell happened to me on Enceladus?" There was a priority message in my queue from the company. Hopefully, I'd learned something from that. They thanked me for my service and told me I had a job as a ranger on Enceladus waiting for me when a Hoshiday became available. There was also hazard pay and a bonus, a rather hefty bonus, enough to cover a couple of Hoshiday mortgage payments. So I must have frozen my Hoshiday doing something useful. I'd have to look up what happened. At least this Pytheon piece of shit was cheap. I'd be able to hold on to that money and do odd jobs on Titan while waiting for a Hoshiday to become available. Although I didn't want to admit it at the time, I knew in the back of my mind that I still had a bright future. Yes, I was stuck in a Pytheon for now, but I'd get another Hoshiday someday. My grand plan would have to be postponed for a while, but I'd live.